ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 17th of December. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. A large crowd gathered at Bondi Beach again last night at the site of Sunday's massacre, with the lighting of candles for the Hanukkah, the Jewish festival of lights. While police have been praised for their efforts on Sunday, the New South Wales government's facing criticism for not providing enough security at the weekend celebrations. Catherine Gregory spoke with Jewish people at Bondi last night who say they're torn over whether to hide their Jewish identity or further risk their safety.
The third night of Hanukkah, and in Bondi, the second night of a vigil for those killed and injured in Sunday's mass shooting. Darren was at the Jewish holiday festival on Sunday when he heard the piercing sound of gunshots.
Just saw from this kind of vantage point where we were, just thousands of people, hordes just running in Bondi. So I knew something was very wrong.
He fled the park and eventually found shelter in someone's garage.
I called my mum, I called my sister, and I just told them I'm safe, but I think it's a terrorist attack at the Hanukkah event. Eventually I got a call back from my imma and she said, it's Hanukkah. And I just fell to my knees.
Returning here, Darren is trying to make sense of what happened in a place he always thought he'd be safe.
A bit all over the place. Like, I've just been having nightmares of what happened. So there's shock. But then at the same time, there's no surprise. This has been 2 years of relentless anti-Semitic incidents. It has slowly been normalised and accepted. So I don't know what you do. Are the government going to give us counter-terrorist operatives at all the public Jewish events? Or on the flip side, we appease the terrorists and we hide and we do everything in private?
A dilemma common to many of the Jewish people AM spoke to, like for this mother and son.
If something like this can even happen in Australia, it just makes you wonder, like, are Jews really safe anywhere?
Some Jewish people I've been speaking to have talked about potentially leaving Australia. Others are talking about, you know, increasing their personal security. Is this something you've considered?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Leaving?
Yeah, I would leave, without a doubt. I think I'd feel safer in Israel.
Simone Abel is from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry and says Jewish people have felt under threat for years now.
Now, what does it say about Australia in 2025 that you can't enter a Jewish institution without going through security points?
Many of the Jewish people AM spoke to praised the efforts and bravery of police on Sunday, as have our leaders. But New South Wales Premier Chris Minns has faced criticism that there weren't enough police officers at Sunday's Hanukkah celebrations.
How many police were stationed there? Was it a failure of staffing?
I don't think there's any doubt that if we had our time again, of course we would do things differently.
Tony Loughran is a global risk specialist and says there needs to be a full investigation into whether police responded too slowly.
But I suppose the question mark has to be really the tactical support group, TSG, and just exactly, you know, what is happening with that particular timescale. You know, how quickly could they get on the scene?
He's concerned police resources are stretched, particularly the TSG, and wants an inquiry to look at how it fits in with the main policing system.
The bottom line is it's not about kind of putting, you know, boots on the ground. It's about surveillance and counter-surveillance.
Global risk specialist Tony Loughran, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. AM's Alison Shaw is at Bondi Beach. Alison, the first victim's funeral is happening this morning.
That's right, Sabra. Large crowds are expected to attend the funeral this morning of popular Jewish leader, 41-year-old Rabbi Eli Schlanger, who will be farewelled at the Chabad of Bondi Synagogue this morning. Police and security is going to be stepped up for the event, with some street closures in the vicinity of the synagogue to allow for the large gathering. And that service is also going to be live streamed. The rabbi has been honoured in recent days as a tireless and devoted leader. Many in the Jewish community have been paying tribute to him. He was well known to many of their leaders, and he often drove many hours to provide pastoral support in regional areas across the state. Now, he's been a rabbi for nearly two decades, and he leaves behind a wife and five children, including one who is just a few months old.
More details are emerging too about some remarkable acts of heroism.
It's really another amazing act of heroism that's been captured on video and circulated on social media. It shows a couple, Boris and Sophia Gurman, trying to intervene in this attack. The 69-year-old retired mechanic, Boris Gurman, is seen in this video wearing a purple shirt as he grabs the older shooter, 50-year-old Sajid Akram, and they both fall to the ground. And the video shows Boris Gurman managing to disarm the shooter on the side of the road on Campbell Parade near that footbridge. Boris Gurman and his wife, Sophia, who would have celebrated her 62nd birthday today, have now been confirmed dead in a statement from the Jewish Board of Deputies, both victims in this terrorist act. The family of the couple have released a statement saying they are just heartbroken by this sudden and senseless loss. They say the couple would have been celebrating their 35th wedding anniversary just in January. And the family says that the couple were Bondi locals who lived honest, hardworking lives and treated everyone with kindness, and they feel an overwhelming sense of pride in their bravery and selflessness. We also know another victim who was killed, 61-year-old Reuven Morrison, has also been identified as a man who threw a brick at one of the gunmen, and his daughter said that his efforts allowed a woman and her baby to flee to safety. So these are just some of the stories of courage and heroism that have been shining through in this dark time, including, of course, that video of Ahmed El Ahmed, who disarmed one of the shooters and is still in hospital recovering. He's among 27 people who are being treated in hospital, and 9 of those are either in a critical or critical but stable condition.
Alison Shaw there at Bondi Beach. Later today, the Federal Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, will hand down the mid-year budget update known as MIEFO. He's also a permanent member of the government's National Security Committee of Cabinet. Normally, the economic numbers would be front and centre of political debate. Instead, the government's facing multiple questions over the Bondi massacre. The Treasurer joined me a short time ago. Jim Chalmers, we'll get to the mid-year budget update in a moment. First, these gunmen trained in the Philippines prior to the attack. The father was licensed with 6 weapons. The son was investigated 6 years ago for links with others associated with ISIS, dismissed at the time for not meeting the threshold. In this era of big data, why doesn't ASIO, the Federal Police and State Policing Agencies, have shared data that might have raised red flags on all of this?
Well, all of this will be part of the investigation that our agencies are conducting, and I think there are good reasons not to get into some of those details or to speculate. We have to let our agencies do their job, and part of doing their job will be conducting a really thorough investigation into what's gone on here.
Australia's social cohesion is being tested now like never before. Former Prime Minister John Howard says the government's focus on gun law reform is a distraction from Anthony Albanese's greatest failure. They're Mr. Howard's words, to not provide the moral leadership that a Prime Minister can in denouncing anti-Semitism since the October the 7th attacks. How do you respond to that?
Well, a couple of things about that. First of all, I've been working very closely with the PM this week, as we all have. I've seen the way that he's been leading the Cabinet and leading the National Security Committee of Cabinet, and I know that he doesn't see this as an either-or, and we don't see this as an either-or. We're focused on both of those things simultaneously, countering these horrifying and evil acts of anti-Semitism at the same time as we tighten our gun laws. And frankly, in relation to Mr. Howard, I don't know why in the week of a mass shooting, some politicians, some current and some former, are trying to diminish our efforts to tighten our gun laws. John Howard, of all people, should understand how important this is. We are capable of dealing with both serious issues at once, and that's the Prime Minister's approach to it. It's not an either-or, and I find it strange in the extreme that in the week of a mass shooting that some politicians are trying to diminish or downplay the important role that tighter gun laws could play in our response to this.
It's not just Mr. Howard. The Jewish community has warned for a long time that the community didn't feel safe. It wanted more than words. 3 former security chiefs today have lashed the government in the Australian newspaper for not doing enough. The opposition has set up its own task force today to respond. Perceptions are everything in politics, and the government is looking a bit flat-footed.
Well, first of all, I understand that the Jewish community is extremely angry, and so are we. And we understand that emotions are raw, and for good reasons. This was a horrific, evil act of anti-Semitism in one of our most iconic communities. And so I understand that people are hurting. I think the whole country is hurting. And it needs to be said that we can always do more, and we should always do more. But the government has acted on a number of the Siegel Report recommendations. We've also taken some very decisive steps to combat anti-Semitism. I mean, there's a long list of things that we have progressed. You know, the new sanctions on Telegram, the landmark ban on the Nazi salute, the criminalising of doxing, the hate crimes database, the extra money for security around schools and synagogues, the legislation around hate speech. The government has acted on a number of fronts, but we say that understanding that the Jewish community would like us to do more, the Australian community would like us to do more, and we will.
To today's budget update, there still will be deficits for the next 10 years. Will you give a specific figure today of government spending as a percentage of GDP, as was the practice up until your first budget?
We have always given a number on government spending as a proportion of GDP. We've got spending as a proportion of the economy down from almost a third under our predecessors. We got it down to about a quarter. Now it's in the high 26%. And it will go down over the course of the forward estimates. And so that's a number which is a consistent feature of budgets and budget updates. And what it will show is that spending as a share of the economy is lower than the peak that we saw under our predecessors, and will get lower still.
Many people are worried about the legacy being left for younger Australians in terms of debts and deficits and the inability of young people to buy a first home in the cities, that prices just keep going up. Will your government address the structural imbalances in a real way in the next budget in May, or perhaps leave it to another federal election agenda?
When it comes to debt, one of the things that people will see, even in this mid-year budget update that Katie Gallagher and I released later today, is that debt will be down compared to the trajectory that we inherited. And what people will also see is the bottom line is better in every year over the forward estimates, because we've managed the budget sensibly and responsibly. And that's what this mid-year budget update is all about. It's about responsible economic management. Now, you also mentioned housing. So even in a mid-year update, which isn't a mini budget, there aren't lots and lots of new initiatives. We are delivering on our commitment in this mid-year update to build an extra 100,000 homes for first home buyers. We are delivering our commitments here on mental health, $1.1 billion, and fast-tracking tradies, another $100 million. But there are a couple of new elements too. There will be an extra $233 million for the CSIRO, the science organisation. That has been something that we've committed to for some time, an extra $45 million in the last budget, an extra $233 million in this budget, and also our boost to low-income super contributions, which will overwhelmingly benefit the young and people on lower incomes so that they get a better balance when they retire.
Dr. Chalmers, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thanks very much, Sabra.
Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers. Australian authorities have confirmed the two men who carried out the Bondi terror attack were likely driven by Islamic State ideology, and it's emerged the father and son gunman travelled to the Philippines just last month to receive military-style training. Rachel Hayter reports.
The Bondi shooters travelled to the Islamist militant hotspot of the southern Philippines at the start of November, where they received military-style training and returned 2 weeks before Sunday's massacre.
The southern Philippines is home to a range of terrorist, jihadist, terrorist organisations, including Islamic State.
Terrorism expert from the Australian National University, Dr. Levi West, says it's plausible that the father-son duo spent time with a jihadist organisation.
It's entirely possible that these two gunmen spent time in an Islamic State or otherwise jihadist training facility somewhere in the southern Philippines. That being said, it's also important to note that there is a range of ways in which you can receive military training in the Philippines without it being delivered by a terrorist organisation.
Dr. Levi West says if the attackers travelled to the southern Philippines to train with the Islamic State jihadist group, it raises questions about why they weren't detected by Australian or Filipino authorities.
It's not like you can just get on a plane, fly to the southern Philippines and show up at an Islamic State training facility and get trained. You would need to have people vouching for you and verifying you.
Greg Barton is a professor of global Islamic politics at Deakin University.
I think it's reasonable to assume that when they left for the Philippines, they'd already made up their mind about launching the attack they did on in Bondi.
Professor Barton believes the father and son travelled to the Philippines seeking support from the Islamic State movement.
What they were determined to do was something that was awfully radical for them and for their victims. So it would be expected that that psychological process of coming around to finally go ahead is not straightforward. Meeting with people who they regarded as spiritual leaders who prayed with them and endorsed their plans would go a long way to confirming to them that they should proceed.
The Philippines National Bureau of Investigation is working with other Filipino government agencies to look back at the movements of the gunmen during the month they spent in the country. The Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, has released a statement saying she's grateful for her Filipino counterpart's condolences on behalf of the Philippines over the anti-Semitic Bondi attack, and that Australia and the Philippines have long cooperated on regional security. The Australian Federal Police Commissioner Chrissy Barrett says while there's no evidence yet to suggest other people were involved in the attack, that could change given it's early in the investigation.
Rachel Hayter there. The heroic actions of Ahmed Al-Ahmed, the Syrian immigrant to Australia who disarmed one of the Bondi terrorists, have reverberated around the world, especially in the Middle East. His friends and relatives in his tiny hometown have told the ABC the Sydney fruit shop owner is a kind man who can't stand injustice or cruelty. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
Al Naydab is a small town in northwest Syria where the homes are made of grey Besser brick. The inhabitants told the ABC they work in construction or have small farms, growing olives and grain and raising sheep and cattle. Ahmad Al-Ahmad's uncle, Wahid Al-Ahmad, says his nephew left this town after high school.
He was a student in the 10th or 11th grade. Circumstances forced him to leave and travel in search of work. He stayed in school for a year or two, then conditions allowed him to leave, and he travelled with the sole intention of working.
Mr. Al-Ahmad says his nephew served in the Syrian military prior to leaving the country, explaining how he knew how to handle a gun. He also says his relative has a strong sense of justice.
He's a brave and honourable young man. He cannot tolerate injustice or corruption. He rejects wrongdoing and meanness. He saw the scene before him. He saw people, human beings, lying on the ground. You know how Arabs, Syrians are. They carry dignity and a deep sense of honour, and they despise disgrace and betrayal.
His cousin Rad Abdelhamid Al-Ahmad says he's given the locals something to be proud of.
I saw the videos and I was shocked. I saw what everyone was saying, people sharing them all over social media. And yes, he is my cousin. I was surprised by what happened. He has been a resident of Australia for 20 years. He did a good thing.
Ahmad Al-Ahmad's former neighbours, like Abed Al-Rahman Al-Muhammad, are especially impressed.
I know him. He's from my village. We as the people of the village of Al Nayrab, and I specifically, are proud of his action to save dozens of innocent lives who are about to lose their lives in this terrorist execution. We in the village of Al Nayrab are proud of the act of heroism.
Ahmad Al-Ahmad has become a celebrity across the Arab world. His uncle Mohammed says his actions have been an inspiration for people enduring war, instability and hardship.
Ahmad,
what Ahmed did is a source of pride for us, for Arabs, for Islam and for Muslims, given that he performed an heroic act that saved several lives, regardless of knowing if they were Christians or Muslims or otherwise. It was a humanitarian act he performed that we're proud of, and we have the pride for us, for Syria and the Arab nation in general.
The Middle East's difficult times continue, but for many people, the actions of one man from a small village in rural Syria were a bright spot during a dark act.
Eric Torchek there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Andy Park for the ABC News Daily Podcast. Who could do such a thing? That's the question Australians are asking after Sunday's mass shooting at Bondi Beach, killing 15 people. How did they radicalise? What drove them to pull off the worst terror attack in Australia's history? Today, what we know about the shooters and the unresolved questions for our security services. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.